Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where we strive to be an open-minded and an open-hearted group of people. We welcome you no matter where you are on life's journey, what some call a spiritual journey or a sacred journey. You are welcome here, no matter your ethnicity, no matter your family structure, no matter your gender orientation or your sexual preferences, you are welcome here. If this is one of your first times, we encourage you to come again because our services are very different from, or can be very different from Sunday morning to Sunday morning. Sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's consulting minister. Sometimes people from outside the congregation do the service, and sometimes some of you do the service. The opening words are these. We come together to hold each other up through difficult times. On days when you are feeling intimidated, you can be with people who have courage. When you feel yourself slipping into despair, you can look into the eyes of people who still have hope. We join together because we are stronger that way. We light this chalice to remind us to keep alive the flame of kindness in our everyday lives. In the words of Unitarian Universalist minister Kimberly DeBus, kindness disrupts lawlessness and incivility. Kindness goes out of its way. Kindness recycles. Kindness holds the door. Kindness builds a ramp. Kindness explains. And kindness knows its privilege and uses it to build justice. Kindness is not easy. Kindness requires us to not stay comfortable, to not stay nice and docile. Two brief readings. First from Unitarian Universalist minister John Burens, who was several years ago president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. He writes, "We all have expectations. We look outward through a little chink in our armor, one conditioned by our background, our experience, our doubts, and our faith. The true ground of our hope is not in our expectations, however, no matter how good, how grand, or how humble. It lies in the hubbub which upsets our expectations and reorders our perceptions. We are constantly being challenged, therefore, to become more inclusive, mature, and enduring in our love. I will not offer the cynic's advice. Blessed are those who expect nothing, for they shall never be disappointed. But I will tell all those who approach our churches and our fellowships that the dawn may not appear just where you expect. Your new religious community will not always fill your every desire. On the other hand, you may perhaps find, almost certainly in unexpected ways, something of what you truly need. Blessed are those who yearn for deepening more than escape, who can renounce smugness and be shaken in conscience, who are not afraid to grow in spirit." And from UU Minister David Bumbaugh, he writes, "Unitarian Universalists were unprepared," this was in the 1960s, "unprepared for the emergence within their own ranks of a demand for black power. committed to desegregation and the creation of a racially integrated society, they had focused little attention upon the fact that segregation was only one manifestation of racism, and that the end of segregation would not signal the end of racism. They had forgotten the warning of the Universalists, who in 1853 noted that slavery was only the beginning of the problem, that ultimately we must conquer our miserable prejudices. Over a century earlier, Universalists had understood that racism was not just a black problem, it was primarily a white problem, which would demand significant changes in the dominant community. Wrapped up in the political struggles of the 1960s, Unitarian Universalists were so busy trying to change them, which Bumbaugh puts in quotes, trying to change them, they had little time to examine the racist assumptions built into their own predominantly white upper middle class institution. On March 17th of this year, Peter Morales, then president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, was asked why the leaders of all five regions into which we have now divided ourselves in this country, why the leaders of all these regions were white. His answer was less than stellar, certainly less than presidential, especially considering that Morales is a person of color himself. Suddenly, we found ourselves as Unitarian Universalists in the midst of a crisis. Our current crisis of conscience has deep roots in both the culture of this country and in our specific culture as a faith tradition, that is, as Unitarians and Universalists. The position of director of our southern region had become available, and filling it came down to two people, a white male minister and a Chicana Latina, her words, director of administration and finance at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church, UU, you think we have an awkward name sometimes, in Charlottesville, Virginia. Both of these two finalists for the position were on the Unitarian Universalist Association's Board of Trustees. The white male was offered the job. The other candidate, Christina Rivera, called out, criticized, questioned the UUA's hiring process. Was this justified? Her questioning of the process, or was it sour grapes? Someone, and it was probably President Morales, told her that she was, quote, not the right fit for the team. Now, I have learned that saying something like that, and I've just learned this recently, is code, or can be code, for racism and sexism. Other isms too, I'm sure. Well, I didn't know this. I have spent a lot of my life in a bubble. Social media picked up on our angst, our denomination's angst, and on our institution's attempt to take a cold, hard look at reality. Social media exploded over this. Turns out that only 8 out of 56 people who have supervisory responsibilities at the UUA are people of color. Aisha Hauser, Director of Religious Education at East Shore Unitarian Church in Bellevue, Washington, put this out on social media. It's not enough to say we believe in equality. It's not about intention, but impact. And the impact is a white supremacy paradigm. Paradigm, example, with zero accountability. Blue, which stands for Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism, called this controversy a moment of crisis for our faith. We cannot effectively respond to looming threats of white supremacy beyond us until we tackle the white supremacy within us. Specific, drastic, and swift changes are needed. We cannot effectively respond to looming threats of white supremacy beyond us until we tackle the white supremacy within us. Peter Morales resigned on April 1st, even though he only had 3 months left in his second and final term as president. Between then and now, much has happened, including our annual General Assembly, which occurs every year in late June. Some of you will remember that the UUA asked our member congregations to scrap their programming for one Sunday, either the last Sunday in April or the first Sunday in May. A lot of you probably aren't aware of this, but the UUA asked us to instead have teach-ins about this white supremacy culture we are part of, particularly the culture of white supremacy within Unitarian Universalism. Prairie chose not to participate. I agreed with that decision. In fact, I probably instigated it, or at least recommended to the program committee, the social action committee, and the board that we not take part in this mandated, my word, not the UUA's. This is how I saw it, mandated decision from on high. You've trained me well. Well, I was wrong. I didn't get it. Oh, I'm certainly not opposed to having teach-ins about racism and white supremacy here at Prairie sometime later. I thought that it was a little over the top to use the phrase white supremacy when talking about people in Unitarian Universalist congregations. That's not who we are. And we all know that, right? I don't feel that way now. I don't believe that anymore. All of us white folks are somewhere on the white supremacy spectrum with hoods and torches and those marches, those terrible marches on one end of the spectrum, and us kind, caring, nice folks thinking we're over here on the other end of the spectrum. But in thinking this way, we neglect one fundamental piece of information. We can't help but be on that spectrum because we swim in that sea, that ocean, that river of white supremacy. We were born into it. We have breathed it every day of our lives. We are not even aware that we are surrounded, immersed, and engulfed in these white supremacy waters. If you read my column in the November issue of Prairie Fire, our monthly newsletter, please read your newsletter. And if you're not getting your newsletter, please let me know. But if you read that column, you'll know that I have been getting interesting responses from folks when I ask the question, are you a white supremacist? My own response to that question back in the spring before GA was, no, of course I am not a white supremacist. What kind of question is that? Well, as I said in my column, if nothing else, it is a question to get your attention. I also wrote, if we are not even willing to put ourselves on this spectrum, try asking this question. What has worked that we white folks have tried? over the centuries. Not much. Certainly there have been gains for people of color, but consider where we are right now in the 21st century. White police routinely shooting black men, income disparity, our prison system, Charlottesville. We should be ashamed, and we should recognize that shame. If just being ashamed isn't going to do us any good, we have to talk about it. We have to recognize it. And we should think radically and creatively about why we have not made much progress in improving race relations in this country over the centuries. Sophia Betancourt. Anybody recognize that name? Very current. Are you reading your literature? We should have homework. She was one of the three interim co-presidents that were appointed to fill in the gap between April and the end of June. She said this in an interview on National Public Radio on June 24th, 2017. What was happening June 24th? Our General Assembly. She said, it's not about whether an individual person considers themselves a white supremacist. It's not about that. It's about how we're all influenced by the everyday messages we receive in our culture, by decisions that we make without even really thinking about it. Okay, somewhere between those upheavals at the UUA in the early spring and General Assembly in New Orleans that last week in June, another Peter and I, that would be our very own Peter Anderson, we had a brief conversation about what was going on and why Prairie wasn't going to do a teach-in Sunday, and about whether or not the UUA's response to all of this was the right response. Would whatever the UUA tried to do be effective? Might not a better course of action be one left to individual congregations and to the members of those congregations? I agreed with Peter at that time. But then I went to General Assembly, and I no longer agreed with him. I should say, though, that Peter, I'm pretty sure we agree on the basics. We agree on the end result. I think we do, and I think it's the means to that end that we're no longer in agreement about. So this is really a two-part presentation. Next week, you'll hear Peter's thoughts and insights, and so I hope you can all be back then. Going to General Assembly, I had a light bulb moment, or more accurately, I should say, this set off a series of light bulb moments for me. I went to something that's done every year at our General Assembly. It's called the Sophia Foss Lecture. Sophia Foss was a famous Unitarian Universalist educator. We still use a lot of her curriculum. The woman who did the Sophia Foss Lecture this year is Robin DiAngelo, who's a white anti-racism educator. Something that she said gave me pause, but now I can't remember exactly what it was. I'm still waiting for a printable version of her talk to come out from the LREDA, Liberal Religious Educated Directors Association. I suddenly got it. Now, there was no way that I got all of it. I just got a tiny, tiny bit of it. It being what it really means to be a person of color in a culture where whiteness reigns supreme. I'll never be able to get all of it because of the color of my skin. Anybody remember the book Black Like Me? If you haven't read it, find it, read it. I suspect it's not even in print, but it will be in libraries.
Well, we probably have a few copies.
We might. Oh, you might at home.
Who knows how many?
Well, that was certainly a light bulb moment when I was about 12 years old. I think that's how old I was when I read it. Is that possible? 12, 14? No. And of course, there was much, much more at General Assembly. There was that lecture, yes. But there was the energy and the presence of so many people of color, especially young people, I have never seen that many people of color all in one place, except in cities. It was so energizing. It opened my eyes, maybe my heart too. This is difficult to explain, but I'm beginning to realize that that light bulb moment at General Assembly was probably a culmination of events, of remembering snippets of conversations, flashbacks from my entire life that somehow blossomed into that aha moment at GA. The Black Like Me book I only remembered yesterday when I was putting some of these remarks together. I have mentioned this before, the conversation that I overheard TSA's having at the Madison Airport. I was behind them. There were two of them, and the gist of it was one of them said to the other, "Well, I'm not prejudiced at all, but I mean it's a fact that prisons only have Black people in them. Therefore, that proves it, that they are inferior." Two white men in Madison. The other one said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I agree." I didn't say anything. I should have. I had a plane to catch, but still. The vendor yesterday at the farmer's market. Yes, I went to the last farmer's market. Still warming up.
Yeah.
There were drums. I knew there were drums. I could hear drums. I thought, oh, somebody's playing drums, you know, around the square. And I go to this vendor, white man, about my age, suddenly says, "I guess it's not too cold for them to come out of the jungle." We are white supremacists. We wouldn't say that. I don't think anybody in this room would say that. But I didn't say anything back. I just looked blank and said, "What? Who's them? It's great music." I had a flashback at GA or later, right after, about the fact that in my lifetime, I was a big swimmer, still swim. People of color couldn't swim where I was swimming. Well, unless I was in the ocean or something. Well, even then, probably not. Years ago, Michelle Bentley, who happens to be Black, a wonderful woman, suddenly started weeping at a Central Midwest District meeting where I was on the board then. And I happened to be beside her, and we were singing some song. I don't remember what it was. I just remember embracing her, but I didn't have a clue. One year at General Assembly, again many years ago, the workshop where I was, all the people of color left the room. They were upset about the failure of school integration. It wasn't working, but they were really upset that the white folks in the room didn't get it. Once to every soul and nation. Do you know the original title of that hymn? Once to every man and nation. So progress. Incrementally. Yes, many years ago. Written by a Unitarian. Once to every soul and nation comes the moment to decide. Well, I think there's probably more often than once, hopefully. Well, what I'm trying to say this morning is really difficult. Racism, white supremacy, white privilege, these are complex subjects. I'm not expecting to solve anything today. It's quite possible that I will offend you this morning. Good, I hope I do. It is quite possible that you will get defensive. Good. I'm trying to make this a little easier for you to absorb by coming back again and again to our core values with that story, with the responsive reading, with the other readings, and I, of course, speak with the greatest kindness possible because I love all of you. Well, we are way off track, even we progressives, especially we progressives. I have often mentioned what Joanna Macy and others say about trying to take a cold, hard look at reality. It is necessary work, this naming of what we are ashamed about, this grieving for the pain we have, however inadvertently and with the best of intentions, caused others. We can't become fully human until we recognize these things. I also want to emphasize that what I am saying this morning is not about bringing more people of color into our congregations. That, if and when it happens, will be That's an end result. That's not the goal right now. More people of color will come if we build it. That is, if we first do the internal work and lay the groundwork for what beloved community is and can be. The immediate work right now, the work right now, is to disrupt and dismantle the white supremacist culture that we are immersed in. Now, that may seem like a big way out there goal, so we begin with hope. And with giant leaps of creativity and imagination, but we also begin with small baby steps, such as devoting regular Sunday morning services to this subject, and yes, going to teach-ins and seminars and lectures and workshops, and the movie that our Social Action Committee has arranged for us. We'll be doing more and more of this sort of thing, I hope. We begin by educating ourselves. Rebecca Parker, one of my heroes, theologian, preeminent theologian of the 20th century, president of Star King School for the Ministry when I was there, said this in 1999 at that General Assembly, and I've used this quote before, "The construction of identity as a white person is to become more ignorant." Construction of our identity as white people is to become more ignorant rather than seeing and understanding the world we actually live in. Think of the culture we live in. We're not supposed to see and understand the world we actually live in. We're supposed to be ignorant of it. She goes on to say something that I hope we would all agree with. Knowledge allows us to disrupt injustice. Knowledge allows us to disrupt injustice. To know is to love. So we begin to unlearn this kind of thinking that we've all been conditioned to when we participate in teach-ins and workshops and go to seminars and movies and lectures. I believe that's way past time for us white folks to get out of the way and follow the lead of our sisters and brothers of color. We need to stop thinking that we know what is best for everyone else. We need to stop assuming that everyone wants to be just like us. We need to step back and shut up for a while and listen to people whose skin color is not white. Because if we have all the answers, then why do white police routinely shoot young black men? That was another aha moment for me. If we just started hearing about this fairly recently, it's the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? What about all the ones we haven't heard about that have gone on and on through the years? Why did Charlottesville happen? Why are there disproportionate numbers of people of color in the prison system? Why do blacks still not make the same wages for similar jobs that whites make? Why? Well, because we still do not act as if black lives matter as much as white lives. Here's a very short quiz for you. Only two questions. I'll grade them later. No, I'm not going to grade them. Sometimes I find it easier to just go to the source rather than keying everything back in. So here's the first question. Who was, this is an unusual name, Gloster, Glosster Dalton? If anybody in this room knows that, I will probably faint. I didn't know who he was. I don't know if you're not getting this magazine, you should be, if you're a BookSign member of Prairie. Someone told me the other day, a fairly long time member, they're not getting it. So please let me know so we can get you on the list. It's a good magazine. If you get this and you haven't yet read Unitarian Universalist Minister Mark Morrison Reed's article in the current issue, and Mark is black, I'll read it. He writes, "Are you confused? this faith that you love has said over and over, sometimes in word, but more often in deed, Black lives don't matter. I'll get back to the quiz in a minute. How many of you know anything about the General Assemblies in 1967, 68, especially 1968 in Cleveland? But was I'm not going to take the time right now to go into it, and it is I can tell you about it later. But essentially, it was what David Bumbaugh referred to in the reading I did, that the Black folks in our congregations demanded equality, and they formed. There are a whole bunch of acronyms here. We've got BAC, B-A-C. The Black Affairs Council. We've got BAWA, B-A-W-A, the Black and White Alternative. It was a mess. It was a huge mess. Eventually, after much argument and acrimony and at two GAs, 1968 and 69, and much and walking out, the Black groups walked out of several business meetings. Eventually, the Board of Trustees of the General Assembly agreed to, I'm trying to find the figure here, to fund, they wouldn't give BAWA, Black and White Alternative, they wouldn't give that group any money. They decided not to give that money. But they decided to give the Black Affairs Council $1 million paid over a four-year period, which was a considerable amount of money. I mean, it still would be, but especially in 1968. Well, we never paid it. And there have been a lot of consequences. No, I don't think we paid any of it. We're still kind of reeling from that. How many years ago was this? 50, 60 years ago? 50. There were reasons. There are always reasons. We were in a mess financially, and that General Assembly wasn't really aware of that. This was also the period of Vietnam and, of course, the Civil Rights Movement. There was lots going on. UUs were putting a lot of energy into social justice. But remember that we didn't merge. The Unitarians and the Universalists didn't merge until 61. And so this, the UUA was really new still in the late 60s, really raw, really trying to figure out how to be organized, how to incorporate both those denominations. So we didn't pay it. But now we have a chance. Now we have a chance to make up for not doing that then. Because now we are being asked to do the exact same thing for Blue. Black Lives of Unitarian Universalists. We have pledged, as an organization, $5 million over the next, I think, 4 years. We have been given a gift of $1 million by Julie and Brad Bradbird. Not a name I recognize. Not only have they pledged $1 million, but they have also challenged us, the congregations within the UUA, to match that pledge in 1 year. So there'll be a program probably in January or February, I would guess. We're not going to try to do it during the holidays, where you're going to be asked to give some money to that. So you'll hear more about that later. James Baldwin wrote, "I love America more than any other country in the world. And for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." I agree. And I also would apply that to this beautiful, amazing tradition of ours. Unitarians and the Universalists, we're rare out there. And we offer a way to the beloved community. You know what I mean by that? To a more level playing field, I guess is one way to say it. But to expanding the circle of who's in the circle, as we all should be in the circle. So I'm worried. I am afraid for our denomination. I'm thinking, okay, who's going to provide the leadership if we give Blue $5 million? Or should I say when? Who will provide the leadership, and will the whites step aside? This was one of the big problems in the 60s. The board at the UUA said, well, okay, we'll give you this money, but we'll direct, we white people, we'll direct how it will be spent, which is one of the reasons for the walkouts by black groups. But I am cautiously optimistic. James Baldwin also wrote that quote at the top of your order of service, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. So, time for me to shut up, probably. I mean, obviously, I could go on and on, but I need to give you the answer to the questions. First of all, who was this Gloucester Dalton? The article that Mark Morrison Reed has in the current issue of UU World is was given at the Mins lecture, which is a pretty hoity-toity lecture. And in it, he tells us our universalist, mostly, history. There were a lot of blacks in our universalist congregations, and not the upper middle class blacks that we have a lot of, actually, in our Unitarian Universalist congregations today. And Mark Morrison Reed goes through the reasons why we lost those people, and he keeps reminding us over and over again that yes, people of color will come into our churches, our congregations. They did originally. So here's Gloucester. He was a signatory at the founding of John Murray's Universalist congregation in 1785. Yes, Gloucester Dalton was a black person. Second question, who was Jeffrey Campbell? Well, he's a more current black man. In 1920, when he was 10, he discovered Universalism, and he became quite fanatical about it. This was in New Hampshire. And he went on to enroll at St. Lawrence University, which was then a Universalist seminary. 50 years later, Campbell told Mark Morrison Reed that when he was admitted to the seminary, the superintendent of the New York State Universalist Convention complained to the dean of that seminary, this is a quote, "Why are we wasting the denomination's money on a nigger?" Wow. This is our history, folks. Wow. We've got lots of good things in our history, too. But we need to look at this. Well, Campbell did graduate in 1935. So, you know, we're talking 1785 with Gloucester there. Now we're talking the 1930s. Relatively close to the current time. We get the nigger quote, and then we get poor Campbell trying to find a job. The Universalists could not find a congregation that was willing to settle him. He tried in 1937 with the Unitarians, same thing. But for me, the aha moments do continue. If you read those last two issues of the World magazine, you'll find some amazing things. Someone writes that we need to create brave space, not safe space. Brave space. I think we could do both. We are committed to making this a time of opportunity, says Bill Sinkford, our only black president of the UUA, who was also one of those three interim presidents from April to June. We have been committed to that journey for decades. I need to read these words. We have to model the world we dream about. The next stage in our journey towards dismantling the white supremacist culture, Bill Sinkford tells us, is to bring the experience and the leadership of persons of color into the center of our faith. Think about that. The next stage is to bring the experience and the leadership of persons of color into the center of our faith. We can't do this alone. We can't do this either as individuals or as congregations. We need the UUA, our Association of Congregations. So I am cautiously optimistic. If you have read this latest issue, you know that under our new first woman ever president of the UUA, we now have a commission on institutional change. I'm heartened by the possibility of systemic change. Systemic change is the only kind of change that makes any difference. It's the most basic requirement, the most basic step in dismantling our sexist, racist culture. I'm obviously awed by Julian Bradford's gift, and I'm excited about a possible eighth principle. Here's the rough wording of it, rough draft. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. I am sure we're going to hear a lot about this at the next as we debate this. I'm sure we're going to tear it all apart. And I'm sure people are going to say, oh my God, we can't use the word spiritual. But overall, I'm excited by the possibility of this amendment. Amendment, principle. So this is where we find ourselves right now. We find ourselves at one of those moments when we have to determine in the stride of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side, which side are we on? The brave one chooses while the coward stands aside. We've been here before in our history, many times before. I hope we're the brave ones and not standing cowardly aside this time. So next Sunday, Peter, it's your turn. And I think you want a lot of input, if possible, right? No back and forthing. General Assembly, and I mentioned there were lots of people of color there, especially young people, and they were in leadership roles. They even moderated the business meetings. We broke rules. We changed things. Many of them would, I'm going to use the word spectrum again, many of those young people of color are in the LGBTQ, so on, the letters community. No, there will be none of that. And that's the one thing that I think we'll argue the most about when we talk about this eighth principle. You can't just say racism, dismantling racism, but does say other oppressions. I think we need to name those other oppressions in the eighth principle. So, good question. No, there'll be no sacrificing. We build on foundations we did not lay. We warm ourselves by fires we did not light. We sit in the shade of trees we did not plant. We drink from wells we did not dig. We profit from persons we did not know. We are ever bound in community. May it be so. Greet your neighbor, drink coffee, go to your meetings.